empty stretch of space across the street, an abandoned park encircled by a jagged line that began as distant skyscrapers and came down to factory chimneys. She saw a few lights in the windows of dilapidated houses, a few small, grimy shops closed for the night, and the fog of the East River 2 blocks away. She started back toward the center of the city. The black shape of a ruin rose before her. It had been an office building long ago. She saw the sky through the naked steel skeleton and the angular remnants of the bricks that had crumbled. In the shadow of the ruin, like a blade of grass fighting to live at the roots of a dead giant, there stood a small diner. Its windows were a bright band of glass and light. She went in. There was a clean counter inside, with a shining strip of chromium at the edges. There was a bright metal boiler and the odor of coffee. A few derelicts sat at the counter. A husky elderly man stood behind it, the sleeves of his clean white shirt rolled at the elbows. The warm air made her realize, in simple gratitude, that she had been cold. She pulled her black velvet cape tight about her and sat down at the counter. "A cup of coffee, please," she said. The men looked at her without curiosity. They did not seem astonished to see a woman in evening clothes enter a slum diner. Nothing astonished anyone these days. The owner turned impassively to fill her order. There was, in his stolid indifference, the kind of mercifulness that asks no questions. She could not tell whether the four at the counter were beggars or working men. Neither clothes nor manner showed the difference these days. The owner placed a mug of coffee before her. She closed both hands about it, finding enjoyment in its warmth. She glanced around her and thought, in habitual professional calculation, how wonderful it was that one could buy so much for a dime. Her eyes moved from the stainless steel cylinder of the coffee boiler to the cast-iron griddle, to the glass shelves, to the enameled sink, to the chromium blades of a mixer. The owner was making toast. She found pleasure in watching the ingenuity of an open belt that moved slowly, carrying slices of bread past glowing electric coils. Then she saw the name stamped on the toaster. Marsh, Colorado. Her head fell down on her arm on the counter. "It's no use, lady," said the old bum beside her. She had to raise her head. She had to smile in amusement at him and at herself. "It isn't?" she asked.
"No. Forget it. You're only fooling yourself."
"About what?"
"About anything being worth a damn. It's dust, lady, all of it. Dust and blood. Don't believe the dreams they pump you full of, and you won't get hurt."
"What dreams?"
"The stories they tell you when you're young, about the human spirit. There isn't any human spirit. Man is just a low-grade animal, without intellect, without soul, without virtues or moral values. An animal with only 2 capacities, to eat and to reproduce."
His gaunt face, with staring eyes and shrunken features that had been delicate, still retained a trace of distinction. He looked like the hulk of an evangelist or a professor of aesthetics who had spent years in contemplation in obscure museums. She wondered what had destroyed him. What error on the way could bring a man to this?
"You go through life looking for beauty, for greatness, for some sublime achievement," he said. "And what do you find? A lot of trick machinery for making upholstered cars or inner spring mattresses."
"What's wrong with inner spring mattresses?" said a man who looked like a truck driver.
"Don't mind him, lady. He likes to hear himself talk. You don't mean no harm." "Man's only talent is an ignoble cunning for satisfying the needs of his body," said the old bum. "No intelligence is required for that. Don't believe the stories about man's mind, his spirit, his ideals, his sense of unlimited ambition."
"I don't," said a young boy who sat at the end of the counter. He wore a coat ripped across one shoulder. His square-shaped mouth seemed formed by the bitterness of a lifetime.
"Spirit?" said the old bum. There's no spirit involved in manufacturing or in sex. Yet these are man's only concerns. Matter. That's all men know or care about. As witness our great industries, the only accomplishment of our alleged civilization, built by vulgar materialists with the aims, the interests, and the moral sense of hogs. It doesn't take any morality to turn out a 10-ton truck on an assembly line.
What is morality? She asked.
Judgment to distinguish right and wrong, vision to see the truth, courage to act upon it, dedication to that which is good, integrity to stand by the good at any price. But where does one find it?
The young boy made a sound that was half chuckle, half sneer. Who is John Galt? She drank the coffee, concerned with nothing but the pleasure of feeling as if the hot liquid were reviving the arteries of her body.
I can tell you, said a small, shriveled tramp who wore a cap pulled low over his eyes. I know.
Nobody heard him or paid any attention. The young boy was watching Dagny with a kind of fierce, purposeless intensity.
You're not afraid, he said to her suddenly, without explanation, a flat statement in a brusque, lifeless voice that had a note of wonder.
She looked at him.
No, she said. I'm not. I know who is John Galt, said the tramp. It's a secret, but I know it.
Who? She asked, without interest.
An explorer, said the tramp. The greatest explorer that ever lived. The man who found the Fountain of Youth.
Give me another cup.
Black, said the old bum, pushing his cup across the counter. John Galt spent years looking for it. He crossed oceans, and he crossed deserts, and he went down into forgotten mines, miles under the earth. But he found it on the top of a mountain. It took him 10 years to climb that mountain. It broke every bone in his body. It tore the skin off his hands. It made him lose his home, his name, his love. But he climbed it. He found the Fountain of Youth, which he wanted to bring down to men. Only he never came back.
Why didn't he? She asked.
Because he found that it couldn't be brought down.
The man who sat in front of Reardon's desk had vague features and a manner devoid of all emphasis, so that one could form no specific image of his face, nor detect the driving motive of his person. His only mark of distinction seemed to be a bulbous nose, a bit too large for the rest of him. His manner was meek, but it conveyed a preposterous hint, the hint of a threat deliberately kept furtive, yet intended to be recognized. Reardon could not understand the purpose of his visit. He was Dr. Potter, who held some undefined position with the State Science Institute.
"What do you want?" Reardon asked for the third time.
"It is the social aspect that I am asking you to consider, Mr. Reardon," the man said softly. "I urge you to take note of the age we're living in. Our economy is not ready for it."
"For what?"
Our economy is in a state of extremely precarious equilibrium. We all have to pool our efforts to save it from collapse.
Well, what is it you want me to do?
These are the considerations which I was asked to call to your attention. I am from the State Science Institute, Mr. Reardon.
You've said so before, but what did you wish to see me about?
The State Science Institute does not hold a favorable opinion of Reardon Medill.
You've said that, too.
Isn't that a factor which you must take into consideration?
No.
The light was growing dim in the broad windows of the office. The days were short. Reardon saw the irregular shadow of the nose on the man's cheek, and the pale eyes watching him. The glance was vague, but its direction purposeful.
The State Science Institute represents the best brains of the country, Mr. Reardon.
So I'm told. Surely you do not want to pit your own judgment against theirs? I do.
The man looked at Reardon as if pleading for help, as if Reardon had broken an unwritten code which demanded that he should have understood long ago. Reardon offered no help.
"Is this all you wanted to know?" he asked.
"It's only a question of time, Mr. Reardon," the man said placatingly. "Just a temporary delay. Just to give our economy a chance to get stabilized. If you'd only wait for a couple of years..."
Reardon chuckled, gaily, contemptuously. "So that's what you're after. Want me to take Reardon Metal off the market? Why?"
"Only for a few years, Mr. Reardon. Only until..."
"Look," said Reardon, "now I'll ask you a question. Did your scientists decide that Reardon Metal is not what I claim it is?"
"We have not committed ourselves as to that."
"Did they decide it's no good?"
"It is the social impact of a product that must be considered. We are thinking in terms of the country as a whole. We are concerned with the public welfare and the terrible crisis of the present moment, which..."
"Is Reardon Metal good or not?"
"If we view the picture from the angle of the alarming growth of unemployment, which at present..."
"Is Reardon Metal good?"
"At a time of desperate steel shortage, we cannot afford to permit the expansion of a steel company which produces too much, because it might throw out of business the companies which produce too little, thus creating an unbalanced economy which..."
"Are you going to answer my question?"
The man shrugged. "Questions of value are relative. If Reardon Metal is not good, it's a physical danger to the public. If it is good, it's a social danger."
"If you have anything to say to me about the physical danger of Reardon Metal, say it. Drop the rest of it. Fast. I don't speak that language."
"But surely questions of social welfare..."
"Drop it."
The man looked bewildered and lost, as if the ground had been cut from under his feet. In a moment he asked helplessly, "But what then is your chief concern?"
"The market."
"How do you mean?"
"There's a market for Reardon Metal, and I intend to take full advantage of it."
"Isn't the market somewhat hypothetical? The public response to your metal has not been encouraging. Except for the order from Taggart Transcontinental, you haven't obtained any major..."
"Well then, if you think the public won't go for it, what are you worrying about?"
"If the public doesn't go for it, you will take a heavy loss, Mr. Reardon."
"That's my worry, not yours."
"Whereas, if you adopt a more cooperative attitude and agree to wait for a few years..."
"Why should I wait?"
"But I believe I have made it clear that the State Science Institute does not approve of the appearance of Reardon Metal on the metallurgical scene at the present time."
"Why should I give a damn about that?"
The man sighed. "You are a very difficult man, Mr. Reardon."
The sky of the late afternoon was growing heavy, as if thickening against the glass of the window panes. The outlines of the man's figure seemed to dissolve into a blob among the sharp, straight planes of the furniture. "I gave you this appointment," said Reardon, "because you told me that you wished to discuss something of extreme importance. If this is all you had to say, you will please excuse me now. I am very busy."
The man settled back in his chair. "I believe you have spent 10 years of research on Reardon Metal," he said. "How much has it cost you?"
Reardon glanced up. He could not understand the drift of the question, yet there was an undisguised purposefulness in the man's voice. The voice had hardened. $1.5 million, said Reardon.
"How much will you take for it?"
Reardon had to let a moment pass. He could not believe it.
"For what?" he asked, his voice low. "For all rights to Reardon Metal."
"I think you had better get out of here," said Reardon.
"There is no call for such an attitude. You are a businessman. I am offering you a business proposition. You may name your own price."
"The rights to Reardon Metal,"
are not for sale.
I am in a position to speak of large sums of money. Government money.
Reardon sat without moving, the muscles of his cheeks pulled tight, but his glance was indifferent, focused only by the faint pull of morbid curiosity.
You are a businessman, Mr. Reardon. This is a proposition which you cannot afford to ignore. On the one hand, you are gambling against great odds. You are bucking an unfavorable public opinion. You run a good chance of losing every penny you put into Reardon Metal. On the other hand, we can relieve you of the risk and the responsibility at an impressive profit, an immediate profit, much larger than you could hope to realize from the sale of the metal for the next 20 years. The State Science Institute is a scientific establishment, not a commercial one, said Reardon. What is it that they're so afraid of?
You are using ugly, unnecessary words, Mr. Reardon. I am endeavoring to suggest that we keep the discussion on a friendly plane. The matter is serious.
I am beginning to see that.
We are offering you a blank check on what is, as you realize, an unlimited account. What else can you want? Name your price.
The sale of the rights to Reardon Metal is not open to discussion. If you have anything else to say, please say it and leave. The man leaned back, looked at Reardon incredulously, and asked,
What are you after?
I? What do you mean?
You're in business to make money, aren't you?
I am.
You want to make as big a profit as possible, don't you?
I do.
Then why do you want to struggle for years, squeezing out your gains in the form of pennies per ton, rather than accept a fortune for Reardon Metal? Why?
Because it's mine. Do you understand the word? The man sighed and rose to his feet.
I hope you will not have cause to regret your decision, Mr. Reardon, he said.
The tone of his voice was suggesting the opposite.
Good day, said Reardon. I think I must tell you that the State Science Institute may issue an official statement condemning Reardon Metal.
That is their privilege.
Such a statement would make things more difficult for you.
Undoubtedly.
As to further consequences, the man shrugged. This is not the day for people who refuse to cooperate. In this age, one needs friends. You are not a popular man, Mr. Reardon.
What are you trying to say?
Surely you understand.
I don't.
Society is a complex structure. There are so many different issues awaiting decision, hanging by a thin thread. We can never tell when one such issue may be decided, and what may be the decisive factor in a delicate balance. Do I make myself clear?
No. The red flame of poured steel shot through the twilight. An orange glow, the color of deep gold, hit the wall behind Reardon's desk. The glow moved gently across his forehead. His face had an unmoving serenity.
The State Science Institute is a government organization, Mr. Reardon. There are certain bills pending in the legislature which may be passed at any moment. Businessmen are peculiarly vulnerable these days. I am sure you understand me.
Reardon rose to his feet. He was smiling. He looked as if all tension had left him. No, Dr. Potter, he said, I don't understand. If I did, I'd have to kill you. The man walked to the door, then stopped and looked at Reardon in a way which, for once, was simple human curiosity. Reardon stood motionless against the moving glow on the wall. He stood casually, his hands in his pockets.
Would you tell me?
The man asked.
Just between us. It's only my personal curiosity. Why are you doing this?
Reardon answered quietly. I'll tell you. You won't understand. You see, it's because Reardon Metal is good. Dagny could not understand Mr. Moen's motive. The Amalgamated Switch and Signal Company had suddenly given notice that they would not complete her order. Nothing had happened. She could find no cause for it, and they would give no explanation. She had hurried to Connecticut to see Mr. Moen in person, but the sole result of the interview was a heavier, grayer weight of bewilderment in her mind. Mr. Moen stated that he would not continue to make switches of Reardon metal. For sole explanation, he said, avoiding her eyes, "Too many people don't like it."
"What? Reardon metal? Or you're making the switches?"
"Both, I guess. People don't like it. I don't want any trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Any kind."
"Have you heard a single thing against Reardon metal that's true?"
"Oh, who knows what's true? That resolution of the National Council of Metal Industries said..."
"Look, you've worked with metals all your life. For the last 4 months you've worked with Reardon metal. Don't you know that it's the greatest thing you've ever handled?"
He did not answer.
"Don't you know it?"
He looked away.
"Don't you know what's true?"
"Hell, Miss Taggart, I'm in business. I'm only a little guy. I just want to make money."
"How do you think one makes it?"
But she knew that it was useless. Looking at Mr. Moen's face, at the eyes which she could not catch, she felt as she had felt once on a lonely section of track when a storm blew down the telephone wires. That communications were cut and that words had become sounds which transmitted nothing. It was useless to argue, she thought, and to wonder about people who would neither refute an argument nor accept it. Sitting restlessly in the train on her way back to New York, she told herself that Mr. Moen did not matter, that nothing mattered now except finding somebody else to manufacture the switches. She was wrestling with a list of names in her mind, wondering who would be easiest to convince, to beg, or to bribe. She knew the moment she entered the anteroom of her office that something had happened. She saw the unnatural stillness, with the faces of her staff turned to her, as if her entrance were the moment they had all waited for, hoped for, and dreaded. Eddie Willers rose to his feet and started toward the door of her office, as if knowing that she would understand and follow. She had seen his face. No matter what it was, she thought, she wished it had not hurt him quite so badly.
"The State Science Institute," he said quietly, when they were alone in her office, "has issued a statement warning people against the use of Reardon metal." He added, "It was on the radio. It's in the afternoon papers." "What did they say?"
"Dagny, they didn't say it.
They haven't really said it, yet it's there.
And it isn't.
That's what's monstrous about it."
His effort was focused on keeping his voice quiet. He could not control his words. The words were forced out of him by the unbelieving, bewildered indignation of a child screaming in denial at his first encounter with evil.
"What did they say, Eddie?"
"They..." "You'd have to read it." He pointed to the newspaper he had left on her desk. "They haven't said that Reardon metal is bad. They haven't said that it's unsafe. What they've done is..." His hands spread and dropped in a gesture of futility. She saw at a glance what they had done. She saw the sentences. "It may be possible that after a period of heavy usage, a sudden fissure may appear, though the length of this period cannot be predicted. The possibility of a molecular reaction, at present unknown, cannot be entirely discounted. Although the tensile strength of the metal is obviously demonstrable, certain questions in regard to its behavior under unusual stress are not to be ruled out. Although there is no evidence to support the contention that the use of the metal should be prohibited, a further study of its properties would be of value."
"We can't fight it."
"It can't be answered," Eddie was saying slowly. "We can't demand a retraction. We can't show them our tests or prove anything.
They've said nothing.
They haven't said a thing that could be refuted and embarrass them professionally.
It's the job of a coward.
You'd expect it from some con man or blackmailer.
But Dagny, It's the State Science Institute.
She nodded silently. She stood, her eyes fixed on some point beyond the window. At the end of a dark street, the bulbs of an electric sign kept going on and off, as if winking at her maliciously. Eddie gathered his strength and said in the tone of a military report, "Taggart stock has crashed. Ben Neely quit. The National Brotherhood of Road and Track Workers has forbidden its members to work on the Rio Norte line. Jim has left town." She took her hat and coat off, walked across the room, and slowly, very deliberately, sat down at her desk. She noticed a large brown envelope lying before her. It bore the letterhead of Reardon Steele.
"That came by special messenger, right after you left," said Eddie.
She put her hand on the envelope, but did not open it. She knew what it was. The drawings of the bridge. After a while, she asked, "Who issued that statement?" Eddie glanced at her and smiled briefly, bitterly, shaking his head.
"No," he said, "I thought of that, too.
I called the Institute long distance and asked them. No, it was issued by the office of Dr. Floyd Ferris, their coordinator." She said nothing.
"But still,
Dr. Stadler is the head of that institute. He is the institute. He must have known about it. He permitted it. If it's done, it's done in his name.
Dr. Robert Stadler. Do you remember when we were in college how we used to talk about the great names in the world? The men of pure intellect. And we always chose his name as one of them, and—"
He stopped. "I'm sorry, Dagny. I know it's no use saying anything. Only—" She sat, her hand pressed to the brown envelope.
"Dagny,"
he asked, his voice low,
"what is happening to people? Why did that statement succeed? It's such an obvious smear job. So obvious and so rotten. You'd think a decent person would throw it in the gutter. How could—"
His voice was breaking in gentle, desperate, rebellious anger.
"How could they accept it? Didn't they read it? Didn't they see? Don't they think? Dagny, what is it in people that lets them do this? And how can we live with it?"
"Quiet, Eddie," she said. "Quiet. Don't be afraid." The building of the State Science Institute stood over a river of New Hampshire, on a lonely hillside, halfway between the river and the sky. From a distance it looked like a solitary monument in a virgin forest. The trees were carefully planted, the roads were laid out as a park, the rooftops of a small town could be seen in a valley some miles away. But nothing had been allowed to come too close and detract from the building's austerity. The white marble of the walls gave it a classical grandeur. The composition of its rectangular masses gave it the cleanliness and beauty of a modern plant. It was an inspired structure. From across the river, people looked at it with reverence and thought of it as a monument to a living man whose character had the nobility of the building's lines. Over the entrance, a dedication was cut into the marble. "To the fearless mind, to the inviolate truth." In a quiet aisle, in a bare corridor, a small brass plate, such as dozens of other nameplates on other doors, said, "Dr. Robert Stadler." At the age of 27, Dr. Robert Stadler had written a treatise on cosmic rays, which demolished most of the theories held by the scientists who preceded him. Those who followed found his achievement somewhere at the base of any line of inquiry they undertook. At the age of 30, he was recognized as the greatest physicist of his time. At 32, he became head of the Department of Physics of the Patrick Henry University, in the days when the great university still deserved its glory. It was of Dr. Robert Stadler that a writer had said, "Perhaps among the phenomena of the universe which he is studying, none is so miraculous as the brain of Dr. Robert Stadler himself." It was Dr. Robert Stadler who had once corrected a student, "Free scientific inquiry. The first adjective is redundant." At the age of 40, Dr. Robert Stadler addressed the nation, endorsing the establishment of a state science institute. "Set science free of the rule of the dollar," he pleaded. The issue had hung in the balance. An obscure group of scientists had quietly forced a bill through its long way to the floor of the legislature. There had been some public hesitation about the bill, some doubt, an uneasiness no one could define. The name of Dr. Robert Stadler acted upon the country like the cosmic rays he studied. It pierced any barrier. The nation built the white marble edifice as a personal present to one of its greatest men. Dr. Stadler's office at the Institute was a small room that looked like the office of the bookkeeper of an unsuccessful firm. There was a cheap desk of ugly yellow oak, a filing cabinet, two chairs, and a blackboard chalked with mathematical formulas. Sitting on one of the chairs against a blank wall, Dagny thought that the office had an air of ostentation and elegance together. Ostentation because it seemed intended to suggest that the owner was great enough to permit himself such a setting. Elegance because he truly needed nothing else. She had met Dr. Stadler on a few occasions, at banquets given by leading businessmen of great engineering societies, in honor of some solemn cause or another. She had attended the occasions as reluctantly as he did, and had found that he liked to talk to her. "Miss Taggart," he had said to her once, "I never expect to encounter intelligence. That I should find it here is such an astonishing relief." She had come to his office, remembering that sentence. She sat, watching him in the manner of a scientist, assuming nothing, discarding emotion, seeking only to observe and to understand. "Miss Taggart," he said gaily, "I'm curious about you. I'm curious whenever anything upsets a precedent. As a rule, visitors are a painful duty to me. I am frankly astonished that I should feel such a simple pleasure in seeing you here. Do you know what it's like to feel suddenly that one can talk without the strain of trying to force some sort of understanding out of a vacuum?" He sat on the edge of his desk, his manner gaily informal. He was not tall, and his slenderness gave him an air of youthful energy, almost of boyish zest. His thin face was ageless. It was a homely face, but the great forehead and the large gray eyes held such an arresting intelligence that one could notice nothing else. There were wrinkles of humor in the corners of the eyes, and faint lines of bitterness in the corners of the mouth. He did not look like a man in his early 50s. The slightly graying hair was his only sign of age. "Tell me more about yourself," he said. "I always meant to ask you what you're doing in such an unlikely career as heavy industry, and how you can stand those people."
"I cannot take too much of your time, Dr. Stadler."
She spoke with polite, impersonal precision.
"And the matter I came to discuss is extremely important."
He laughed.
"There's a sign of the businessman. Wanting to come to the point at once. Well, by all means. But don't worry about my time. It's yours. Now, what was it you said you wanted to discuss?" "Oh, yes. Reardon Metal. Not exactly one of the subjects on which I'm best informed, but if there's anything I can do for you..." His hand moved in a gesture of invitation.
"Do you know the statement issued by this institute in regard to Reardon Metal?"
He frowned slightly.
"Yes, I've heard about it."
"Have you read it?"
"No."
"It was intended to prevent the use of Reardon metal."
"Yes, yes, I gathered that much."
"Could you tell me why?"
He spread his hands. They were attractive hands, long and bony, beautiful in their suggestion of nervous energy and strength.
"I really wouldn't know. That is the province of Dr. Ferris. I'm sure he had his reasons. Would you like to speak to Dr. Ferris?"
"No." "Are you familiar with the metallurgical nature of Reardon metal, Dr. Stadler?"
"Why, yes, a little. But tell me, why are you concerned about it?"
A flicker of astonishment rose and died in her eyes. She answered without change in the impersonal tone of her voice,
"I am building a branch line with rails of Reardon metal, which..."
"Oh, but of course. I did hear something about it.
You must forgive me. I don't read the newspapers as regularly as I should. It's your railroad that's building that new branch, isn't it?
The existence of my railroad depends upon the completion of that branch. And I think eventually the existence of this country will depend on it as well.
The wrinkles of amusement deepened about his eyes.
Can you make such a statement with positive assurance, Miss Taggart?
I couldn't.
In this case?
In any case. Nobody can tell what the course of a country's future may be. It is not a matter of calculable trends, but a chaos subject to the rule of the moment, in which anything is possible.
Do you think that production is necessary to the existence of a country, Dr. Stadler?
Why, yes. Yes, of course.
The building of our branch line has been stopped by the statement of this institute.
He did not smile, and he did not answer.
Does that statement represent your conclusion about the nature of Reardon metal? She asked.
I have said that I have not read it. There was an edge of sharpness in his voice. She opened her bag, took out a newspaper clipping, and extended it to him.
Would you read it, and tell me whether this is a language which science may properly speak?
He glanced through the clipping, smiled contemptuously, and tossed it aside with a gesture of distaste. Disgusting, isn't it? He said. But what can you do when you deal with people?
She looked at him, not understanding. You do not approve of that statement.
He shrugged. My approval or disapproval would be irrelevant.
Have you formed a conclusion of your own about Reardon metal?
Well, metallurgy is not exactly, what shall we say, my specialty.
Have you examined any data on Reardon metal?
Miss Taggart, I don't see the point of your questions. His voice sounded faintly impatient.
I would like to know your personal verdict on Reardon metal.
For what purpose?
So that I may give it to the press.
He got up. That is quite impossible, she said, her voice strained with the effort of trying to force understanding.
I will submit to you all the information necessary to form a conclusive judgment.
I cannot issue any public statements about it.
Why not?
The situation is much too complex to explain in a casual discussion.
But if you should find that Reardon metal is, in fact, an extremely valuable product, which...
That is beside the point.
The value of Reardon metal is beside the point?
There are other issues involved besides questions of fact. She asked, not quite believing that she had heard him right.
What other issues is science concerned with besides questions of fact?
The bitter lines of his mouth sharpened into the suggestion of a smile. Miss Taggart, you do not understand the problems of scientists. She said slowly, as if she were seeing it suddenly in time with her words.
I believe that you do know what Reardon metal really is.
He shrugged. Yes, I know. From such information as I've seen, it appears to be a remarkable thing. Quite a brilliant achievement, as far as technology is concerned.
He was pacing impatiently across the office.
In fact, I should like some day to order a special laboratory motor that would stand just such high temperatures as Reardon metal can take. It would be very valuable in connection with certain phenomena I should like to observe. I have found that when particles are accelerated to a speed approaching the speed of light, they...
Dr. Stadler, she asked slowly, you know the truth, yet you will not state it publicly.
Miss Taggart, you are using an abstract term when we are dealing with a matter of practical reality.
We are dealing with a matter of science.
Science? Aren't you confusing the standards involved? It is only in the realm of pure science that truth is an absolute criterion. When we deal with applied science, with technology, we deal with people. And when we deal with people, considerations other than truth enter the question.
What considerations?
I am not a technologist, Miss Taggart. I have no talent or taste for dealing with people. I cannot become involved in so-called practical matters.
That statement was issued in your name.
I had nothing to do with it.
The name of this institute is your responsibility.
That's a perfectly unwarranted assumption.
People think that the honor of your name is the guarantee behind any action of this institute.
I can't help what people think, if they think at all.
They accepted your statement. It was a lie.
How can one deal in truth when one deals with the public?
I don't understand you,
she said very quietly. Questions of truth do not enter into social issues. No principles have ever had any effect on society.
What, then, directs men's actions?
He shrugged. The expediency of the moment.
Dr. Stadler, she said, I think I must tell you the meaning and the consequences of the fact that the construction of my branch line is being stopped. I am stopped in the name of public safety because I am using the best rail ever produced. In 6 months, if I do not complete that line, the best industrial section of the country will be left without transportation. It will be destroyed because it was the best, and there were men who thought it expedient to seize a share of its wealth.
Well, that may be vicious, unjust, calamitous, but such is life in society. Somebody is always sacrificed, as a rule, unjustly. There is no other way to live among men. What can any one person do?
You can state the truth about Reardon Metal.
He did not answer.
I could beg you to do it in order to save me. I could beg you to do it in order to avert a national disaster. But I won't. These may not be valid reasons. There is only one reason. You must say it, because it is true.
I was not consulted about that statement. The cry broke out involuntarily. I wouldn't have allowed it. I don't like it any better than you do, but I can't issue a public denial.
You were not consulted. Then shouldn't you want to find out the reasons behind that statement?
I can't destroy the Institute now.
Shouldn't you want to find out the reasons?
I know the reasons. They won't tell me, but I know. And I can't say that I blame them either.
Would you tell me?
I'll tell you, if you wish. It's the truth that you want, isn't it? Dr. Ferris cannot help it if the morons who vote the funds for this institute insist on what they call results. They are incapable of conceiving of such a thing as abstract science. They can judge it only in terms of the latest gadget it has produced for them. I do not know how Dr. Ferris has managed to keep this institute in existence. I can only marvel at his practical ability. I don't believe he ever was a first-rate scientist. But what a priceless valet of science. I know that he has been facing a grave problem lately. He's kept me out of it. He spares me all that, but I do hear rumors. People have been criticizing the Institute, because they say we have not produced enough. The public has been demanding economy. In times like these, when their fat little comforts are threatened, you may be sure that science is the first thing men will sacrifice. This is the only establishment left. There are practically no private research foundations any longer. Look at the greedy ruffians who run our industries. You cannot expect them to support science.
Who is supporting you now?
She asked, her voice low. He shrugged. Society. She said with effort,
You were going to tell me the reasons behind that statement.
I wouldn't think you'd find them hard to deduce. If you consider that for 13 years this institute has had a department of metallurgical research, which has cost over $20 million and has produced nothing but a new silver polish and a new anti-corrosive preparation, which I believe is not so good as the old ones, you can imagine what the public reaction will be if some private individual comes out with a product that revolutionizes the entire science of metallurgy and proves to be sensationally successful. Her head dropped. She said nothing. "I don't blame our metallurgical department," he said angrily. "I know that results of this kind are not a matter of any predictable time. But the public won't understand it. What, then, should we sacrifice? An excellent piece of smelting, or the last center of science left on Earth, and the whole future of human knowledge? That is the alternative." She sat, her head down. After a while, she said, "All right, Dr. Statler, I won't argue." He saw her groping for her bag, as if she were trying to remember the automatic motions necessary to get up. "Miss Taggart," he said quietly. It was almost a plea. She looked up. Her face was composed and empty. He came closer. He leaned with one hand against the wall above her head, almost as if he wished to hold her in the circle of his arm. "Miss Taggart," he said, a tone of gentle, bitter persuasiveness in his voice, "I am older than you. Believe me, there is no other way to live on Earth. Men are not open to truth or reason. They cannot be reached by a rational argument. The mind is powerless against them. Yet we have to deal with them. If we want to accomplish anything, we have to deceive them into letting us accomplish it, or force them. They understand nothing else. We cannot expect their support for any endeavor of the intellect, for any goal of the spirit. They are nothing but vicious animals. They are greedy, self-indulgent, predatory dollar chasers who—" "I am one of the dollar chasers, Dr. Statler," she said, her voice low. "You are an unusual, brilliant child who has not seen enough of life to grasp the full measure of human stupidity. I've fought it all my life. I'm very tired." The sincerity of his voice was genuine. He walked slowly away from her. "There was a time when I looked at the tragic mess they've made of this earth, and I wanted to cry out, to beg them to listen. I could teach them to live so much better than they did. But there was nobody to hear me. They had nothing to hear me with. Intelligence? It is such a rare, precarious spark that flashes for a moment somewhere among men and vanishes. One cannot tell its nature, or its future, or its death." She made a movement to rise. "Don't go, Miss Taggart. I'd like you to understand." She raised her face to him in obedient indifference. Her face was not pale, but its planes stood out with strangely naked precision, as if its skin had lost the shadings of color. "You're young," he said. "At your age, I had the same faith in the unlimited power of reason, the same brilliant vision of man as a rational being. I have seen so much since. I have been disillusioned so often. I'd like to tell you just one story." He stood at the window of his office. It had grown dark outside. The darkness seemed to rise from the black cut of the river far below. A few lights trembled in the water from among the hills of the other shore. The sky was still the intense blue of evening. A lonely star, low over the earth, seemed unnaturally large and made the sky look darker. "When I was at the Patrick Henry University," he said, "I had three pupils. I have had many bright students in the past, but these three were the kind of reward a teacher prays for. If ever you could wish to receive the gift of the human mind at its best, young and delivered into your hands for guidance, they were this gift. Theirs was the kind of intelligence one expects to see in the future, changing the course of the world. They came from very different backgrounds, but they were inseparable friends. They made a strange choice of studies. They majored in two subjects, mine and Hugh Axton's, physics and philosophy. It is not a combination of interests one encounters nowadays. Hugh Axton was a distinguished man, a great mind. Unlike the incredible creature whom that university has now put in his place, Axton and I were a little jealous of each other over these three students. It was a kind of contest between us, a friendly contest, because we understood each other. I heard Axton saying one day that he regarded them as his sons. I resented it a little, because I thought of them as mine.
He turned and looked at her. The bitter lines of age were visible now, cutting across his cheeks. He said, "When I endorsed the establishment of this institute, one of these three damned me. I have not seen him since. It used to disturb me in the first few years. I wondered once in a while whether he had been right. It has ceased to disturb me long ago."
He smiled. There was nothing but bitterness now in his smile and his face. "These three men, these three who held all the hope which the gift of intelligence ever proffered, these three from whom we expected such a magnificent future. One of them was Francisco D'Anconia, who became a depraved playboy. Another was Ragnar Daniskjold, who became a plain bandit. So much for the promise of the human mind."
"Who was the third one?" she asked.
He shrugged. "The third one did not achieve even that sort of notorious distinction. He vanished without a trace, into the great unknown of mediocrity. He is probably a second assistant bookkeeper somewhere."
"It's a lie. I didn't run away," cried James Taggart. "I came here because I happened to be sick. Ask Dr. Wilson. It's a form of flu. He'll prove it. And how did you know that I was here?"
Dagny stood in the middle of the room. There were melting snowflakes on her coat collar, on the brim of her hat. She glanced around, feeling an emotion that would have been sadness had she had time to acknowledge it. It was a room in the house of the old Taggart estate on the Hudson. Jim had inherited the place, but he seldom came here. In their childhood, this had been their father's study. Now it had the desolate air of a room which is used, yet uninhabited. There were slipcovers on all but two chairs, a cold fireplace, and the dismal warmth of an electric heater with a cord twisting across the floor, a desk, its glass surface empty. Jim lay on the couch with a towel wrapped for a scarf around his neck. She saw a stale, filled ashtray on a chair beside him, a bottle of whiskey, a wilted paper cup, and two-day-old newspapers scattered about the floor. A portrait of their grandfather hung over the fireplace, full figure, with a railroad bridge in the fading background.
"I have no time for arguments, Jim."
"It was your idea. I hope you'll admit to the board that it was your idea. That's what your goddamn Reardon medal has done to us. If we had waited for Orrin Boyle..." His unshaved face was pulled by a twisted scramble of emotions. Panic, hatred, a touch of triumph, the relief of screaming at a victim, and the faint, cautious, begging look that sees a hope of help. He had stopped tentatively, but she did not answer. She stood watching him, her hands in the pockets of her coat.
"There's nothing we can do now," he moaned. "I tried to call Washington to get them to seize the Phoenix Durango and turn it over to us on the ground of emergency, but they won't even discuss it. Too many people objecting, they say, afraid of some fool precedent or another. I got the National Alliance of Railroads to suspend the deadline and permit Dan Conway to operate his road for another year. That would have given us time, but he's refused to do it. I tried to get Ellis Wyatt and his bunch of friends in Colorado to demand that Washington order Conway to continue operations. But all of them, Wyatt and all the rest of those bastards, refused. It's their skin worse than ours. They're sure to go down the drain. But they've refused."
She smiled briefly, but made no comment. "Now there's nothing left for us to do. We're caught. We can't give up that branch, and we can't complete it. We can't stop or go on. We have no money. Nobody will touch us with a 10-foot pole. What have we got left without the Rio Norte line? But we can't finish it.
We'd be boycotted. We'd be blacklisted. The Union of Track Workers would sue us. They would. There's a law about it. We can't complete that line. Christ! What are we going to do? She waited. Through, Jim? She asked coldly. If you are, I'll tell you what we're going to do. He kept silent, looking up at her from under his heavy eyelids. This is not a proposal, Jim. It's an ultimatum. Just listen and accept. I am going to complete the construction of the Rio Norte line. I personally, not Taggart Transcontinental. I will take a leave of absence from the job of vice president. I will form a company in my own name. Your board will turn the Rio Norte line over to me. I will act as my own contractor. I will get my own financing. I will take full charge and sole responsibility. I will complete the line on time. After you have seen how the Reardon metal rails can take it, I will transfer the line back to Taggart Transcontinental, and I'll return to my job. That is all. He was looking at her silently, dangling a bedroom slipper on the tip of his foot. She had never supposed that hope could look ugly in a man's face, but it did. It was mixed with cunning. She turned her eyes away from him, wondering how it was possible that a man's first thought in such a moment could be a search for something to put over on her. Then, preposterously, the first thing he said, his voice anxious, was, "But who will run Taggart Transcontinental in the meantime?" She chuckled. The sound astonished her. It seemed old in its bitterness. She said, "Eddie Willers." "Oh, no. He couldn't." She laughed in the same brusque, mirthless way. "I thought you were smarter than I about things of this kind. Eddie will assume the title of acting vice president. He will occupy my office and sit at my desk. But who do you suppose will run Taggart Transcontinental?" "But I don't see how." "I will commute by plane between Eddie's office and Colorado. Also, there are long-distance phones available. I will do just what I have been doing. Nothing will change except the kind of show you will put on for your friends, and the fact that it will be a little harder for me."
"What show?"
"You understand me, Jim. I have no idea what sort of games you're tangled in, you and your board of directors. I don't know how many ends you're all playing against the middle and against one another, or how many pretenses you have to keep up in how many opposite directions. I don't know or care. You can all hide behind me. If you're all afraid because you've made deals with friends who were threatened by Reardon Metal, well, here's your chance to go through the motions of assuring them that you're not involved, that you're not doing this. I am. You can help them to curse me and denounce me. You can all stay home, take no risks, and make no enemies. Just keep out of my way."
"Well," he said slowly, "of course, the problems involved in the policy of a great railroad system are complex. While a small independent company, in the name of one person, could afford to..."
"Yes, Jim. Yes, I know all that. The moment you announce that you're turning the Rio Norte line over to me, the Taggart stock will rise. The bedbugs will stop crawling from out of unlikely corners, since they won't have the incentive of a big company to bite. Before they decide what to do about me, I will have the line finished. And as for me, I don't want to have you and your board to account to argue with, to beg permissions from. There isn't any time for that if I am to do the kind of job that has to be done. So, I'm going to do it alone."
"And if you fail?"
"If I fail, I'll go down alone."
"You understand that in such case Taggart Transcontinental will not be able to help you in any way?"
"I understand."
"You will not count on us?"
"No."
"You will cut all official connection with us so that your activities will not reflect upon our reputation?"
"Yes."
I think we should agree that in case of failure or public scandal, your leave of absence will become permanent. That is, you will not expect to return to the post of vice president. She closed her eyes for a moment.
All right, Jim. In such case, I will not return.
Before we transfer the Rio Norte line to you, we must have a written agreement that you will transfer it back to us, along with your controlling interest at cost, in case the line becomes successful. Otherwise, you might try to squeeze us for a windfall profit, since we need that line. There was only a brief stab of shock in her eyes. Then she said indifferently, the words sounding as if she were tossing alms,
"By all means, Jim, have that stated in writing."
"Now as to your temporary successor."
"Yes."
"You don't really want it to be Eddie Willers, do you?"
"Yes, I do."
"But he couldn't even act like a vice president. He doesn't have the presence, the manner, that—"
"He knows his work and mine. He knows what I want. I trust him. I'll be able to work with him."
"Don't you think it would be better to pick one of our more distinguished young men? Somebody from a good family with more social poise and—"
"It's going to be Eddie Willers, Jim."
He sighed.
"All right. Only—"
"Only we must be careful about it. We don't want people to suspect that it's you who were still running Taggart Transcontinental. Nobody must know it."
"Everybody will know it, Jim.
But since nobody will admit it openly, everybody will be satisfied." "But we must preserve appearances."
"Oh, certainly.
You don't have to recognize me on the street if you don't want to. You can say you've never seen me before, and I'll say I've never heard of Taggart Transcontinental." He remained silent, trying to think, staring down at the floor. She turned to look at the grounds beyond the window. The sky had the even, gray-white pallor of winter. Far below, on the shore of the Hudson, she saw the road she used to watch for Francisco's car. She saw the cliff over the river, where they climbed to look for the towers of New York, and somewhere beyond the woods were the trails that led to Rockdale Station. The earth was snow-covered now, and what remained was like the skeleton of the countryside she remembered, a thin design of bare branches rising from the snow to the sky. It was gray and white, like a photograph, a dead photograph which one keeps, hopefully, for remembrance, but which has no power to bring back anything. "What are you going to call it?"
She turned, startled. "What?"
"What are you going to call your company?"
"Oh, why, the Dagny Taggart line, I guess."
"But do you think that's wise? It might be misunderstood. The Taggart might be taken as—"
"Well, what do you want me to call it?" she snapped, worn down to anger. "The Miss Nobody? The Madam X? The John Galt?"
She stopped. She smiled suddenly, a cold, bright, dangerous smile.
"That's what I'm going to call it. The John Galt line."
"Good God, no!"
"Yes."
"But it's just a cheap piece of slang."
"Yes."
"You can't make a joke out of such a serious project. You can't be so vulgar and undignified."
"Can't I?"
"But for God's sake, why?"
"Because it's going to shock all the rest of them, just as it shocked you."
"I've never seen you playing for effects."
"I am this time."
"But—" His voice dropped to an almost superstitious sound.
"Look, Dagny, you know, it's bad luck. What it stands for is—"
He stopped.
"What does it stand for?"
"I don't know. But the way people use it, they always seem to say it out of—"
"Fear? Despair? Futility?"
"Yes. Yes, that's what it is."
"That's what I want to throw in their faces.
The bright, sparkling anger in her eyes, her first look of enjoyment, made him understand that he had to keep still. "Draw up all the papers and all the red tape in the name of the John Galt line," she said. He sighed. "Well, it's your line."
"You bet it is."
He glanced at her, astonished. She had dropped the manners and style of a vice president. She seemed to be relaxing happily to the level of yard crews and construction gangs. "As to the papers and the legal side of it," he said, "there might be some difficulties. We would have to apply for the permission of..." She whirled to face him. Something of the bright, violent look still remained in her face, but it was not gay, and she was not smiling. The look now had an odd, primitive quality. When he saw it, he hoped he would never have to see it again.
"Listen, Jim," she said.
He had never heard that tone in any human voice.
"There is one thing you can do as your part of the deal, and you'd better do it. Keep your Washington boys off. See to it that they give me all the permissions, authorizations, charters, and other waste paper that their laws require. Don't let them try to stop me. If they try..."
"Jim, people say that our ancestor Nat Taggart killed a politician who tried to refuse him a permission he should never have had to ask. I don't know whether Nat Taggart did it or not. But I'll tell you this. I know how he felt if he did. If he didn't, I might do the job for him to complete the family legend. I mean it, Jim."
Francisco D'Anconia sat in front of her desk. His face was blank. It had remained blank while Dagny explained to him, in the clear, impersonal tone of a business interview, the formation and purpose of her own railroad company. He had listened. He had not pronounced a word. She had never seen his face wear that look of drained passivity. There was no mockery, no amusement, no antagonism. It was as if he did not belong in these particular moments of existence and could not be reached. Yet his eyes looked at her attentively. They seemed to see more than she could suspect. They made her think of one-way glass. They let all light rays in, but none out.
"Francisco, I asked you to come here because I wanted you to see me in my office. You've never seen it. It would have meant something to you once."
His eyes moved slowly to look at the office. Its walls were bare, except for three things. A map of Taggart Transcontinental, the original drawing of Nat Taggart that had served as model for his statue, and a large railroad calendar in cheerfully crude colors, the kind that was distributed each year with a change of its picture to every station along the Taggart track, the kind that had hung once in her first workplace at Rockdale. He got up. He said quietly, "Dagny, for your own sake, and..." It was a barely perceptible hesitation.
"And in the name of any pity you might feel for me, don't request what you're going to request. Don't. Let me go now."
This was not like him, and like nothing she could ever have expected to hear from him. After a moment she asked, "Why?"
"I can't answer you. I can't answer any questions. That is one of the reasons why it's best not to discuss it. You know what I am going to request?"
"Yes." The way she looked at him was such an eloquent, desperate question that he had to add,
"I know that I am going to refuse."
"Why?" He smiled mirthlessly, spreading his hands out as if to show her that this was what he had predicted and had wanted to avoid. She said quietly,
"I have to try, Francisco. I have to make the request. That's my part. What you'll do about it is yours. But I'll know that I've tried everything."
He remained standing, but he inclined his head a little in assent and said,
"I will listen, if that will help you. I need $15 million to complete the Rio Norte line. I have obtained $7 million against the Taggart stock I own, free and clear. I can raise nothing else.
I will issue bonds in the name of my new company in the amount of $8 million. I called you here to ask you to buy these bonds.
He did not answer.
I am simply a beggar, Francisco, and I am begging you for money. I had always thought that one did not beg in business. I thought that one stood on the merit of what one had to offer and gave value for value. This is not so anymore, though I don't understand how we can act on any other rule and continue to exist. Judging by every objective fact, the Rio Norte line is to be the best railroad in the country. Judging by every known standard, it is the best investment possible. And that is what damns me. I cannot raise money by offering people a good business venture. The fact that it's good makes people reject it. There is no bank that would buy the bonds of my company, so I can't plead merit. I can only plead.
Her voice was pronouncing the words with impersonal precision. She stopped, waiting for his answer. He remained silent.
I know that I have nothing to offer you, she said. I can't speak to you in terms of investment. You don't care to make money. Industrial projects have ceased to concern you long ago, so I won't pretend that it's a fair exchange. It's just begging.
She drew her breath and said,
Give me that money as alms, because it means nothing to you.
Don't, he said, his voice low. She could not tell whether the strange sound of it was pain or anger. His eyes were lowered.
Will you do it, Francisco?
No. After a moment, she said, I called you, not because I thought you would agree, but because you were the only one who could understand what I am saying. So I had to try it. Her voice was dropping lower, as if she hoped it would make emotion harder to detect.
You see, I can't believe that you're really gone, because I know that you're still able to hear me. The way you live is depraved. But the way you act is not. Even the way you speak of it is not. I had to try. But I can't struggle to understand you any longer.
I'll give you a hint. Contradictions do not exist. Whenever you think that you are facing a contradiction, check your premises. You will find that one of them is wrong.
Francisco, she whispered. Why don't you tell me what it was that happened to you?
Because at this moment, the answer would hurt you more than the doubt.
Is it as terrible as that?
It is an answer which you must reach by yourself. She shook her head.
I don't know what to offer you. I don't know what is of value to you any longer. Don't you see that even a beggar has to give value in return, has to offer some reason why you might want to help him? Well, I thought, at one time, it meant a great deal to you. Success. Industrial success. Remember how we used to talk about it? You were very severe. You expected a lot from me. You told me I'd better live up to it.
I have.
You wondered how far I'd rise with Taggart Transcontinental.
She moved her hand, pointing at the office.
This is how far I've risen. So I thought, if the memory of what had been your values still has some meaning for you, if only as amusement, or a moment's sadness, or just like putting flowers on a grave, you might want to give me the money in the name of that.
No. She said with effort,
that money would mean nothing to you.
You've wasted that much on senseless parties. You've wasted much more on the San Sebastian mines. He glanced up. He looked straight at her, and she saw the first spark of a living response in his eyes, a look that was bright, pitiless, and incredibly proud, as if this were an accusation that gave him strength.
Oh, yes, she said slowly, as if answering his thought. I realize that.
I've damned you for those mines. I've denounced you. I've thrown my contempt at you in every way possible, and now I come back to you for money. Like Jim, like any moocher you've ever met. I know it's a triumph for you. I know that you can laugh at me and despise me with full justice. Well, perhaps I can offer you that. If it's amusement that you want, if you enjoyed seeing Jim and the Mexican planners crawl, wouldn't it amuse you to break me? Wouldn't it give you pleasure? Don't you want to hear me acknowledge that I'm beaten by you? Don't you want to see me crawling before you? Tell me what form of it you'd like, and I'll submit. He moved so swiftly that she could not notice how he started. It only seemed to her that his first movement was a shudder. He came around the desk. He took her hand and raised it to his lips. It began as a gesture of the gravest respect, as if its purpose were to give her strength. But as he held his lips, then his face, pressed to her hand, she knew that he was seeking strength from it himself. He dropped her hand. He looked down at her face, at the frightened stillness of her eyes. He smiled, not trying to hide that his smile held suffering, anger, and tenderness.
Dagny, you want to crawl. You don't know what the word means, and never will. One doesn't crawl by acknowledging it as honestly as that. Don't you suppose I know that your begging me was the bravest thing you could do? But don't ask me, Dagny. In the name of anything I ever meant to you, she whispered, anything left within you.
In the moment when she thought that she had seen this look before, that this was the way he had looked against the night glow of the city, when he lay in bed by her side for the last time, she heard his cry, the kind of cry she had never torn from him before.
My love, I can't.
Then, as they looked at each other, both shocked into silence by astonishment, she saw the change in his face. It was as crudely abrupt as if he had thrown a switch. He laughed. He moved away from her and said, his voice jarringly offensive by being completely casual, "Please excuse the mixture in styles of expression. I've been supposed to say that to so many women, but on somewhat different occasions." Her head dropped. She sat huddled tight together, not caring that he saw it. When she raised her head, she looked at him indifferently.
"All right, Francisco. It was a good act. I did believe it. If that was your own way of having the kind of fun I was offering you, you succeeded. I won't ask you for anything."
"I warned you."
"I didn't know which side you belonged on. It didn't seem possible. But it's the side of Orin Boyle and Bertram Scudder and your old teacher."
"My old teacher?" he asked sharply.
"Dr. Robert Stadler."
He chuckled, relieved.
"Oh, that one.
He's the looter who thinks that his end justifies his seizure of my means." He added,
"You know, Dagny, I'd like you to remember which side you said I'm on. Someday I'll remind you of it and ask you whether you'll want to repeat it."
"You won't have to remind me." He turned to go. He tossed his hand in a casual salute and said, "If it could be built, I'd wish good luck to the Rio Norte line."
"It's going to be built, and it's going to be called the John Galt line."
"What?"
It was an actual scream. She chuckled derisively.
"The John Galt line. Dagny, in heaven's name, why? Don't you like it?
How did you happen to choose that?
It sounds better than Mr. Nemo or Mr. Zero, doesn't it?"
"Dagny, why that?"
"Because it frightens you."
"What do you think it stands for?"
"The impossible. The unattainable.
And you're all afraid of my line just as you're afraid of that name." He started laughing.
He laughed, not looking at her, and she felt strangely certain that he had forgotten her, that he was far away, that he was laughing, in furious gaiety and bitterness, at something in which she had no part. When he turned to her, he said earnestly, "Dagny, I wouldn't if I were you." She shrugged. Jim didn't like it either. "What do you like about it?" "I hate it. I hate the doom you're all waiting for, the giving up, and that senseless question that always sounds like a cry for help. I'm sick of hearing pleas for John Galt. I'm going to fight him." He said quietly, "You are. I'm going to build a railroad line for him. Let him come and claim it." He smiled sadly and nodded. "He will."